on the Interstate Commerce Committee.
Brandegee was also a vociferous anti-suffragist who'd helped block congressional passage of the 19th Amendment for years, working in harmony with Senators James Wadsworth of New York and George Moses of New Hampshire, all of whom were up for re-election in the fall. These incumbents had good reason to fear that if the women of their states were allowed to vote, they might exact revenge on them at the ballot box. Molly Hay was at that very moment leading a revolt within the New York State Republican Party against Wadsworth's renomination. These three senators were Republicans, and they'd been instrumental in choosing Warren Harding as the party nominee inside that famously smoke-filled room in Chicago earlier in the summer. Now they were asking Harding to protect their careers by putting the brakes on the 19th Amendment and keeping women from the polls. The Connecticut and Vermont governors were also under the Atlantic coastline's corporate influence, the theory posited, and the company had probably sent that mystery man, who claimed to represent a syndicate of New York, Connecticut, and Vermont interests, to the Hermitage. "Some of the poor dupes in Nashville do not realize that they are victims of a plot," Paul told the press, blithely insulting the Tennessee legislators. "To return this bitter anti-suffragist Brandegee to the Senate this fall." Amplifying Betty Graham's accusations against Seth Walker, Paul let the fur fly. "Mr. Walker, Speaker of the House, is a young attorney who has, on many occasions, given the most fervent assurances that he would support suffrage. Recently, he was made an attorney for the L&N Railway, and the result is the otherwise inexplicable change of attitude evidenced in his message to President Wilson yesterday, refusing to support the suffrage amendment." It all fit together alarmingly well. That night, Paul sent Abby Baker on another emergency mission to see Warren Harding. She was to impress upon him the damage Senator Brandegee and his railroad minions were causing in Tennessee, and to urge the candidate to do something about it. Baker took a taxi to Harding's house in Marion and was ushered into his study by Florence. Harding was evasive, as usual, but beyond that, Baker found him to be stunningly obtuse.
"Frank Brandegee has no influence in the Senate or anywhere else," Harding told Baker, dismissing her concerns about him. "He only has $100,000.
It seemed a bizarre assessment of a prominent lawmaker, but she let it go. When she told Harding that his letter to Judge Tillman was being used by the L&N lobbyists in Nashville to convince legislators not to ratify, he responded,
"I could not stultify myself by asking a man to vote for ratification if he had conscientious scruples about constitutionality."
Baker explained that those constitutional questions had already been ruled moot by noted legal experts. But Harding only looked at her blankly and repeated robotically,
"I cannot stultify myself."
No matter the argument she put forward, regardless of the evidence she presented, Harding parroted this same answer, "I cannot stultify myself," punctuated by a wiping of his brow.
"Harding looks perfectly stupid," Baker relayed to Alice Paul. "So much so that the newspaper men call him nothing but old stupid. They say he's drinking again, and his appearance confirms the report."
Even in this state, Harding did manage to make a pass at Mrs. Baker. But he said he'd have to ask his campaign manager, Harry Dougherty, whether he should play any further role in Tennessee. Dougherty would tell him no. By Sunday night, August 15th, things seemed murkier than they'd been before, the outcome in the House even more uncertain. The Suffs had come into the special session with 62 signed pledges for ratification from House members. The Woman's Party now reported between 40 and 43 firm commitments, with another dozen pro-ratification votes possible. The Antis claimed some of those firm legislators had pledged to them as well. Both sides projected confidence, both sides predicted victory, but both began to hedge a bit.
Joe Hanover went from an unequivocal declaration on Saturday, "There is absolutely no chance of defeat," to a more measured statement on Sunday, "There is no doubt in my mind that Tennessee would ratify." Sue White admitted that the issue was undecided, but took a literal approach to predicting victory. "We have the votes pledged," she said, "and many of these pledges are in writing and in my possession." Those were old pledges, she knew. Minds had been changed in the meantime, but she'd use those original promises to shame any deserter. Seth Walker insisted he was reasonably sure the House would reject ratification. Reporters understood that neither side had any idea how things might play out. Polls had become meaningless. Everything was in flux. On Sunday evening, a weary Carrie Catt sat at the writing desk in her room and penned a letter to her friend Mary Peck in New York, offering her candid view of the situation in Nashville. "We now have 35.5 states. We are up to our last half of a state. With all the political pressure, it ought to be easy. But the opposition of every sort is here, fighting with no scruple, desperately. Women, including L. Clay and K. Gordon, are here, appealing to negrophobia and every other caveman's prejudice. Men, lots of them, are here. What do they represent? God only knows. We believe they are buying votes. We have a poll of the House showing victory, but they are trying to keep them at home to break a quorum, and God only knows the outcome. We are terribly worried. And so is the other side. I've been here a month. It is hot, muggy, nasty. And this last battle is desperate. We are low in our minds. Even if we win, we who have been here will never remember it with anything but a shudder. Verily, the way of the reformer is hard." Chapter 20. Armageddon. On Monday morning, the mood in Nashville was volatile, even violent. This was the suffrage Armageddon, as both sides considered the impending clash as a defining battle between good and evil, a struggle for the soul of Tennessee and the heart of the nation. When the legislators returned to the city, they were welcomed by a new anti-broadside that made the stakes perfectly clear. "Beware, men of the South, heed not the song of the suffrage siren. Seal your ears against her vocal wiles. For, no matter how sweetly she may proclaim the advantages of female franchise, remember that woman suffrage means a reopening of the entire Negro suffrage question, loss of state rights, and another period of Reconstruction horrors, which will introduce a set of female carpetbaggers as bad as their male prototypes of the 60s. Do not jeopardize the present prosperity of your sovereign states, which was so dearly bought by the blood of your fathers and the tears of your mothers, by again raising an issue which has already been adjusted at so great a cost. Nothing can be gained by woman suffrage, and much may be lost." With the reconvening of the legislature, the Hotel Hermitage lobby became a pedal-strewn battlefield, with men and women shooting suspicious glances at one another, flinging insults and insinuations, hurling accusations of deceit and skullduggery. The opulent lobby, chandeliered dining rooms, and potted-palmed loggia were scenes of shouting matches and shoving, often escalating into fistfights. Overnight, Governor Roberts had been visited by a powerful group of newspaper publishers and warned that unless he reversed course and pulled off his men working for ratification, his political career was over. Stallman's Banner, the Ox's Times, and other Democratic papers that had supported Roberts in the primary would turn their editorial pages against him in the general election. Go Republican.
Robert swallowed hard.
Joe Hanover began receiving telephone calls in the middle of the night, from women and from men. The women spoke in sugary tones, professing to be devoted suffs who wanted to give Hanover some vital information. "Meet me in room something or other," they'd purr. He had to laugh, it was so obvious. He knew that if he walked into that room, the anti-hired photographers would flash their camera bulbs, purporting to catch him in a compromising situation. "No thanks," he answered. But the men's voices on the phone were gruff and sinister, as they delivered naked threats. If he knew what was good for his health, he'd do an about-face on ratification. Governor Roberts ordered Hanover placed under police protection. Captain Paul Bush of the Tennessee State Police was assigned as Hanover's bodyguard, and the strapping trooper took up residence in an adjoining room on the third floor of the Hermitage, monitoring Hanover's mail, telephone calls, and visitors. The delegates, especially those who'd signed pledges to ratify, were also reminded of just how much they and their families might lose if they continued to support ratification. Those who hadn't succumbed to bribes began to be pelted with threats. Job loss, political ruin, career destruction. Their house mortgage just might be foreclosed, their loan called due, their business met with unexpected disaster. Carrie Catt was appalled by reports of blatant extortion, horrified by the idea that shadowy men working for the anti's corporate friends were applying the third degree to lawmakers in hotel rooms around the city. If House members weren't persuaded by these techniques, perhaps they could be dissuaded or prevented from voting at all. Some began receiving phony telegrams claiming their wife was ill, their child injured, their house on fire, to compel them to hastily leave Nashville. Other lawmakers, known to have a weakness for liquor, were entertained for hours in the Jack Daniels suite, plied with whiskey until they were in a stupor, and the resulting hangover was expected to be powerful enough to keep them from the next roll call. When the suffs learned that one such legislator, listed as favorable to ratification, was careening down the Hermitage hallways, they made sure he was escorted by friends to his room, put under a cold shower and sobered up under a fan, then put to bed. He made roll call. Both the House and Senate convened at 2 o'clock. The Senate, relieved of the burden of ratification and unencumbered by hordes of spectators, took up more routine measures. But the House floor and galleries were again crowded with red and yellow-rosed partisans, and similarly bedecked men and women were in animation on the floor, darting from one delegate to the next. Disproving fears about a quorum, attendance was unusually high, with 95 of the 99 delegates in their chairs. There was a heightened buzz of anticipation, as there was some possibility that the vote might be called right then and there. But the Constitutional Amendments Committee hadn't yet met to decide upon its recommendation, and while the suffs might attempt to drag the resolution out of committee onto the House floor for a vote, that would be risky, as such a move required two-thirds of the members to agree, not just a majority. Ratification leaders would execute this maneuver only if they felt very confident of their strength. They were not confident. The antis noticed. The House adjourned until Tuesday morning, pending the decision of the committee. The intervening hours were frantic. As the delegates emerged into the Capitol corridors following adjournment, they were backed into corners by teams of women, adorned with red or yellow, making another round of soprano supplications and alto advocacies. As the lawmakers walked on the sidewalks leading from the State House to the Hermitage, or any of the adjoining streets, they were accosted by zealous proselytizers trying to convert them. Knots of arguing advocates formed on the streets and in the Hermitage lobby, attracting curious onlookers and wisecrackers the way a brawl or a cockfight might. Campaigners were working in relays, wrote reporters on the scene, And when one enthusiastic advocate or antagonist of votes for women became exhausted, there was another one near to take up the task. More bad news was delivered to the Suffs during the day. Nearly the entire Nashville-Davidson County delegation, 5 of the 7 men who had been pledged solidly for ratification, had suddenly defected to the antis. This was the stuff of nightmares. The Davidson delegation was a keystone Democratic bloc and was the responsibility of Luke Lee and his political apparatus to manage. Lee had obviously lost control of his men. Or let them go. Or the railroads, with offices, facilities, and tracks in Nashville, had captured them. Ann Dudley, who'd pledged these Davidson men of her home district, was distraught. Carrie Catt was dismayed, but not deeply shocked, to find that once again the freedom of American women might fall victim to the egos and ambitions of powerful men. As might be expected, the antis were jubilant. Opponents of the federal amendment were emboldened to take daring new steps. The same band of Democratic newspaper publishers who'd visited Governor Roberts was now making the rounds of state Republican leaders, offering a sweet deal. Make sure enough Republican delegates in the House swing against ratification, preventing a majority coalition, and the Democratic newspapers would come out for the Republican ticket from Harding on down. To stimulate more defections, Charlotte Rao publicly offered to defend any delegate who might wish to withdraw the ratification pledge he'd given to the Suffs. If Sue White was threatening to expose delegates who reneged on their pledges, Rao promised to protect them from such disgusting blackmail. She could provide beleaguered legislators with incriminating information about the Suffs. It was the antis' own type of card indexing system. They could play that game. The antis also beefed up their Constitutional League legal team with the arrival of Judge Oscar Lesser, a noted legal scholar who'd piloted efforts to defeat ratification in Maryland. And they augmented their lobbying brigade with former Chattanooga mayor and recent gubernatorial contender Jesse Littleton, who'd so unctuously assured Anita Politzer he was a firm suffragist, now openly working for the antis. In Marion, Warren Harding did the antis another favor. When pressed by reporters for his latest opinions on ratification, Harding speculated that should Tennessee ratify, the constitutional questions swirling around the legislature's action and the legal challenges that would surely follow might throw the fall elections into chaos. Harding was reciting almost verbatim the antis' script. He was skilled at repetition, if not reasoning. His fears about Tennessee's ratification would appear on the front pages of newspapers the next morning. Governor Roberts was just trying to keep his head above water. On his desk was a barbed message from DNC Chairman George White. "I insistently hope the volunteer state, under your magnificent leadership, will keep step with the times." Just as he received another, "I'm depending upon you," telegram from Governor Cox. James Cox was receiving panic-tinged reports from Tennessee all day. Sue White and Anita Politzer wired to him the details of their findings about the probable Walker L&N Brandegee Atlantic coastline connections, and he took them seriously. He mentioned the alleged conspiracy in his daily press briefing, and he authorized a special message sent specifically to Democratic members of the Tennessee House known to have business ties to the L&N, asking them to stand fast for ratification. "Asinine," a spokesman for the railroad called all the rumors about the Louisville and Nashville interfering in Tennessee's ratification fight. The accusations were too absolutely absurd to need a denial, he contended. "What would the L&N be bothering about suffrage for?" he asked. "We have troubles enough of our own." At 8 p.m., the House Committee on Constitutional Amendments, a body of 18 delegates drawn from both political parties, with Speaker Walker attending in an ex officio capacity, convened in the hotel room of its chairman, Tom Riddick, to decide whether to recommend ratification. Hundreds of people gathered in the Hermitage lobby, in the hallways and public rooms, awaiting word of the committee's decision. At a few minutes before the hour, Joe Hanover, who served on the committee, glanced at his pocket watch. Two committee men, both pledged for ratification, were absent. Alert suffragists rounded up the two, who were obviously trying to duck the meeting, and hustled them over to Riddick's room. The meeting was brief, little more than 15 minutes. No debate, not even any real discussion. The first ballot was tied. Joe Hanover was disturbed to see that one of Governor Roberts's close allies, Banks Turner, voted with the antis. Then, without explanation, another of the delegates who'd voted with the antis asked to change his vote. Put him in the I column, favoring ratification. It is possible that Seth Walker signaled him to do this. The committee vote had demonstrated the strength of the antis, and under these circumstances, the quicker Walker could herd his men to a full House vote, the better. The committee, by a vote of 10-8, recommended ratifying the federal amendment. Joe Hanover left the room quickly. The Suffs had won, but the vote was too close. It didn't bode well for the full House vote. When Seth Walker strode out of the committee meeting, he told reporters, "We've got 'em whipped to a frazzle. We have ratification beaten. That is all there is to it." Nashvillians awoke on Tuesday to a bold-faced and boxed advertisement in the Morning Tennessean. An appeal to the citizens of Nashville. Will you, by your presence in the Capitol this morning, help to defeat the Susan B. Anthony Amendment? This is the most important issue that has confronted the South since the Civil War. We appeal to you in the name of Tennessee, in the name of the South, to help us maintain a righteous cause. Wear a red or pink rose. Show your loyalty to the people of your own land. In the name of millions of Southern women, we appeal to the unquestioned chivalry of the South. Josephine Pearson was very proud of this bugle call from her Tennessee Women of the Rejection League, fighting on the front lines, to their kinsmen on the home front. This was the day of the vote, and just as valiant Confederate soldiers had attempted to storm the State House in 1864 to oust the blue-belly Federalist soldiers and release the city from Union occupation in the Battle of Nashville, so she and her fellow antis were willing to face the barrage on Capitol Hill today for the glory and future of Tennessee. And Pearson was confident that the people of Nashville would turn out today to defend their state and protect their heritage. She pinned on her three red roses, her President General insignia, and headed to the State House. The State House was looking a bit too yellow for Miss Pearson's taste. Squads of Suff decorators had been busy since just after dawn, tacking up bunting and banners, hanging flags. Saffron-colored cloth was draped from the columns of the building's portico, while the golden satin banners of the Tennessee suffrage organizations, as well as the Woman's Party's purple, white, and gold standards, were suspended between the Corinthian columns of the House chamber. Some daredevil suffragist had lashed a big yellow sunflower to the spread-winged eagle above the speaker's chair. Waves of people, thousands of people, surged up Capitol Hill in the hours before the session was to begin. The impassioned, the incensed, and even the indifferent came trudging up the hill. Women who'd been in the suffrage fight for years, as well as those who'd ignored it all that time, came to watch a moment of history unfold before their eyes. Mothers brought their daughters. A car filled with women factory workers arrived, all wearing red flowers. They'd been given the day off by their boss to swell the ranks of the antis. The galleries were packed long before the first gavel, as Suff and anti-sympathizers fought over the seats and benches, elbowing one another for a standing room spot. On the floor of the chamber, The area behind the brass bar was already stuffed with standing spectators, and those who couldn't squirm their way in were pushed back into the hallway, where they stood four deep. The chamber floor looked like Union Station's waiting room, with nearly 100 members seated and more than 250 lobbyists milling around them. Seth Walker, his eyes swollen from lack of sleep, stood on the speaker's stand and rapped his gavel at 10:30. The moment the roll call was complete, 95 legislators present, the antis made their first move. They demanded that the floor be cleared of all lobbyists and spectators. A howl of protest went up from the ratificationists. House Rule Number 17 stipulated that no one but legislators were allowed on the floor except as guests of the speaker. The rule was rarely enforced, but it should be now, the anti-delegate insisted. Speaker Walker agreed. Joe Hanover jumped up to protest.
There is no reason to ask America to leave the chamber, he yelled.
The people are entitled to petition their representatives in person. We have nothing to hide. Hanover moved to suspend Rule Number 17. Walker smiled. He'd maneuvered the first test vote. Suspending a House rule required a two-thirds majority. There was no way the Suffs could muster that many votes. The roll was called, with 51 voting aye to allow spectators to remain on the floor, 45 voting no. Not enough. Speaker Walker ordered the sergeant-at-arms to remove all spectators from the chamber floor. It took some minutes for all the Suff and anti-workers to be escorted off the floor. The women did not go willingly. Only then did the real dueling begin. Tom Riddick, as chairman of the Constitutional Amendments Committee, submitted the majority report recommending ratification and kicked off the debate. He put his courtroom dramatic skills to good use and opened with a bang.
"Isn't it time for the South to quit being the tail end of creation, the backyard of civilization, remaining backward on the march of progress?" he cried, calling opposition to woman suffrage a relic of barbarism.
Riddick's arguments ranged from quoting the Golden Rule and Declaration of Independence.
If women are human beings, why shouldn't the first sentence of the Declaration of Independence apply alike to them?
To dismissing the Negro question, along with the various legal complications supposedly impinging upon ratification. And he made a threat.
I have here the pledges of 62 members of this House to ratify the 19th Amendment, right here in black and white, he announced, which the people of Tennessee will have the opportunity to read.
A few legislators looked queasy.
You speak of your conscience? Riddick demanded. What about your conscientious objections to violating your pledge?
More cheers from the yellow-breasted men and women.
If those men fail to keep faith, and this resolution is defeated,
Riddick said slowly and solemnly for emphasis,
I shall go from this chamber a dishonored man, ashamed of being a Tennessean, and doubly ashamed of being a Tennessee Democrat.
Flushed and quivering, Riddick sat down. For the next 3.5 hours, the friends and foes of ratification made their case in the well of the House. Almost every argument ever voiced over the past 7 decades, both for and against woman suffrage, was revived, with the addition of concerns such as states' rights, Southern chivalry, home rule, and the Negro question. And, of course, the loudest themes heard in Nashville during the past weeks, constitutional qualms, oaths of office, the woman's Bible, and certain influences trying to sway the legislature, all popped up during the overheated debate. Frustrated spectators relegated to the State House corridors had to rely upon those standing closer to the chamber door to relay what was being said inside. All they could hear was the ballyhoo. Each time a speaker made a clever remark or a cogent point, fans adorned in either floral yellow or red applauded and cheered, whistled and stomped. Decorum was completely abandoned by both sides. It was the political version of talent night at the local vaudeville house, and the speakers definitely played to the audience, each trying to outdo the other and win the crowd's approval. Creed Boyer took the homespun approach.
"Women are the best thing God ever made," announced the 74-year-old Republican from the mountains of East Tennessee. "And I honor women above all humankind. But I would not pollute them by allowing them to wade through the filthy waters of politics."
The anti-women lobbyists clapped. He was blessed with a wife, 9 daughters, 8 sons, and 8 daughters-in-law, Boyer told his listeners, and all of his womenfolk agreed that he and his sons could adequately represent them at the polls.
"And I guess what's good enough for them will have to be good enough for the rest."
Catherine Kenny remembered Boyer. He'd pledged to ratify until the cows come home. Now he was proud to be voting against ratification, for the sake of his 18 female family members. The suff's hisses were drowned out by the anti's applause. Carrie Cat again kept vigil at the open window of her room, straining to hear the periodic bursts of cheering that spilled down from Capitol Hill. The imposing visage of the State House filled Cat's window frame, just as it dominated the skyline of the city. In that building, at that moment, her cause and the future of American women was being debated and decided by men. She could only watch. Cat was, however, amused to learn that the Tennessee suffs had gotten hold of a replica of the Liberty Bell, that famously cracked symbol of American independence, and installed it in the House chamber this morning, ready to be rung the moment the vote to ratify was won. When it was won. If it was won. For years, in so many of her speeches, Cat had spoken of the moment heralding women's political freedom. The bell of liberty would surely, inevitably ring, she'd say, because there was nothing so powerful, so irresistible, as an idea whose time had come. She'd told that to her suffs in 1916. She'd told that to Congress in 1917. She'd told it to President Wilson in 1918. But sometimes, like this morning, she had to wonder. Some men in that State House across the way were undoubtedly making the same arguments against woman suffrage that Susan Anthony had heard. And some women were still frightened or deluded enough to be applauding them. The vote was likely to be excruciatingly close. Even at this late date, there was no firm consensus, no overwhelming mandate for giving women the vote or permitting their full citizenship. She tried not to wonder whether America was ready to hear the Liberty Bell. They went on and on, hour after hour. George Connolly, a fruit merchant from Memphis, took the floor.
"As a Southern man, I could not refuse to allow women to shed their refulgent rays across the path of politics in the South," Connolly gushed. "Woman is God's chosen creature, and won't she, if taken into our political life, scatter her purity and fragrance into the muddled waters of our political life, and make it as clear as a crystal?"
Percy Sharp, one of the Davidson County defectors, stood to speak of his sleepless nights, worrying about the violence that might be unleashed in the South if universal suffrage was imposed and black women and men were allowed to vote. He could not subject his elderly mother to such indignities.
I reached the decision that I would never put this thing upon my people, he proclaimed, or force woman's suffrage upon the states which don't want it.
The parade of speakers continued.
Taxation without representation should no longer apply to the women of the United States, cried a speaker for the Suffs. This issue has nothing to do with woman's suffrage, insisted an anti-advocate. It is a matter of the Constitution and violation of our oaths. I would be ashamed to admit that my wife, my mother, or my sisters were not as capable of exercising the ballot as I am. The so-called elevation of woman in politics means instead her degradation. The working women of this country should have the same right accorded to Negro chauffeurs or a Negro porter. Tennessee must place the capstone on the Temple of Justice by becoming the 36th state.
The luncheon hour came and went, and stomachs began to growl. The delegates got a bit fidgety. The Suffs noticed and kicked into action. They'd already bought sandwiches and iced tea to feed the hungry legislators, keep them from adjourning, and hold them for a vote. But the House Sergeant-at-Arms, under strict orders from the Speaker to allow no unauthorized person onto the floor, refused to permit the Suffs to distribute the food or even allow the pages to do it. The sandwiches sat uneaten, and the hungry legislators grew grouchier. At some point between a speaker offering a tribute to the glories of womanhood and an orator launching another tirade against Mrs. Catt and the Woman's Bible, a page approached the desk of Delegate Charles Wellesley Brooks, Democrat from Carroll County, and slipped him a telegram. Brooks read it quickly, and the color drained from his face. He sprang out of his chair and made his way to Joe Hanover. Brooks was in the ratification camp. The note brought Brooks the awful news that his wife was seriously ill, and her doctors were imploring him to return home. "I have to go," Brooks whispered into Hanover's ear, explaining the situation. Hanover had to wonder whether the dire warning was real, as there'd been so many fake telegrams of emergencies in the past few days. It was real, but Brooks was needed for this next vote. Hanover begged him to stay. Brooks slipped a folded train schedule from his inside jacket pocket and scanned down the tables. It was a long trip back to his home in West Tennessee. He needed to catch the next fast train. Sue White, Betty Graham, and Anita Politzer stood just behind the brass bar at the rear of the chamber, paying close attention to the speeches, but also watching the delegates themselves. Who was listening? Who was doodling? Who was walking around? Who was whispering to whom? They recorded each procedural vote, and they kept closest tabs on their men, the men they'd pledged or attempted to sway, the ones they could trust, and especially the ones they could not. They noted with irritation, but also a touch of sadness, that Harry Byrne of NIOTA was wearing a red rosebud in his lapel this morning. Byrne was infuriating. He seemed willing to tell each side what they wanted to hear. Most recently, he'd declared himself undecided, but he was voting with the antis. Politzer noticed that Byrne appeared agitated, his baby face lined with worry, his eyes betraying strain. She and Graham felt rather sorry for him. He was their age. He could have been their brother or boyfriend. He was awfully cute. He wasn't a smooth politician. He had an endearing awkwardness about him, an almost comical earnestness. "I cannot pledge myself," he'd whispered to Politzer and Graham when they'd last confronted him. "But I will do nothing to hurt you." What did that mean? All they knew was that they couldn't trust Harry Byrne. After more than 2 hours of bitter back and forth, with tempers sparking and stomachs growling, Seth Walker relinquished the speaker's chair and walked down to clean the floor. Before he could open his mouth, the antis in the chamber began a long, loud ovation for him, which he accepted graciously, with a nod. He looked paler than usual, his eyelids heavy, his voice tighter, his manner agitated. Reporters noted that his nerves seemed more or less unstrung. Nevertheless, The chamber hushed as he launched into what Tennesseans call a real bearcat of a speech.
I thank God I can stand here unfettered and unhampered by political influences or by political aspirations,
Walker opened. He won a loud cheer from the antis while Suffs grimaced.
I resent the statements made by Mr. Riddick that the South is the tail end of creation,
he fumed, his voice rising.
I am a Southerner from the bottom of my foot to the crown of my head. We want this to remain a white man's country.
There was deafening applause from the Red Rose.
I resent charges that I've been influenced by a certain railroad, or that railroad has tried to change the opinion of some members of this body,
Walker shouted. He held up a copy of the General Assembly's oath of office.
We are asked by some to disregard this oath. I don't believe the men of Tennessee will do it. The man who asks you to sacrifice your conviction is not worthy to be called a Tennessean.
Walker read the oath aloud, emphasizing the section where members swear they will not vote for anything injurious to my people. The 19th Amendment was most certainly injurious to the people of Tennessee and to the rest of the South, Walker boomed.
Just as soon as this 19th Amendment, this Susan B. Anthony Amendment, is put upon a state like Georgia,
a state with a large black population,
hell's going to break loose in Georgia.
Are we going to force suffrage upon another Southern state that has rejected it? Walker challenged his colleagues. He read a letter he'd received from certain colored ladies of California, urging the Tennessee legislature to ratify. The Negro women of California always voted 99%, the letter writer said, pointing proudly to the active participation of black Californians who'd been able to vote since 1911, while our white sisters vote only about 20%.
I say this is infamous,
Walker shouted. Walker held a sheaf of documents in his hand and methodically read aloud one, then the next, to make his various points. He gave a dramatic reading of Harding's letter to Judge Tillman, praising Harding's good judgment and character, while provoking a shiver in his fellow Democrats.
I don't know whether Harding or Cox will be elected as president, Walker said slyly. But if Harding should be elected, you will have an honest man.
He then read President Wilson's recent telegram to him, urging ratification. And at this point, the galleries exploded again. But now it was the Suffs causing a ruckus. At Walker's mention of Wilson's name, Anne Dudley climbed atop a bench at the very back of the room, behind the railing where spectators were still permitted to stand, and began shouting, "Wilson! Wilson! Wilson!" followed by a shrill cheer. Little would one have dreamed that this little mite of a woman could possess such vocal powers, wrote the Chattanooga Times. Wilson, the Southern president, was still a demigod to Tennessee Democrats, though he was being branded a traitor by antis of the party. Dudley's call was taken up into the galleries, where Suff women echoed Dudley's Wilson cry, with whoops, trills, yells, whistles, clapping, and foot stomping. It was quite a scene, and it went on for several minutes, drowning out Walker's speech. He paused, waited, and then, sensing a lull in the rumpus, regained control. He read aloud his defiant reply to President Wilson, which elicited an outburst from the antis almost as rowdy as the Suffs had been. Walker then glanced up toward the galleries to address his yellow-sashed tormentors.
Last year, standing about where I am now, I made the fight in this house for the suffrage bill, which you seemed to desire so ardently then. After the fight had been won, I was proclaimed a hero. Today you same women are denouncing me as a Judas, as a Benedict Arnold, as a traitor. I have been insulted right here in this city. It has been said that the Louisville and Nashville Railroad had something to do with dictating my attitude.
Betty Graham may have felt eyes all around the chamber burning into her, but she retained an impassive mien. Walker brushed away those claims, but as the Suffs noticed, he never actually denied that he'd been influenced by the LNN. Walker resented yet another thing Tom Riddick had said earlier in the debate. He was angered by Riddick holding aloft the pledges of legislators who had once promised to ratify and threatening to expose those who'd changed their minds. Walker had his own pile of pledges.
"I have right now in my pocket the written pledges of more than a majority of members of this House that they will vote to defeat this amendment."
And a gasp could be heard in the galleries.
"But before I would show that paper to a living soul, and thus keep any one of these men from voting according to his own conscience, or even threaten to publish the list in an effort to coerce them into voting as they may feel they should not, I would suffer this right arm to be cut off," he cried, extending his arm for effect.
He excited the crimson corsage to another wild ovation.
"Men of Tennessee, be men today," Walker exhorted, bringing his admirers to their feet. "I don't want Democrats or Republicans. I call upon you as men. In good faith and good morals, we cannot ratify."
Walker's concluding words coaxed another round of jubilant acclamation, and the substitute speaker rapped the gavel repeatedly to no avail. Walker had spoken for almost an hour, his passion and fury mesmerizing the chamber. His stem winder seemed to galvanize the antis. With the vote expected to be so close, even the slightest swing in sentiment could spell the difference between success and failure of the amendment. When the delegates emerged from Walker's oratorical spell, they remembered they were hungry. Charlie Brooks slipped his watch from his vest pocket. He couldn't stay very long. It was Joe Hanover's turn, and he was under pressure to score.
"Ours is the great volunteer state," he began, "and women from the east, west, north, and south are looking to us to give them political freedom."
The Suffs in the gallery gazed down upon Hanover's head and beamed.
"The entire world today has cast its eyes on Tennessee. This is a moral question, and that's why I am here, voting for this amendment."
Applause. Hanover wanted to make a soaring oration for suffrage, but he couldn't allow Seth Walker's assertions and allegations to go unchallenged. He tackled them one by one. He countered Walker's slights about black women voting in California with a testimonial from the governor of that state, attesting that politics is cleaner and government is better since California women were given the ballot. Cheers. He refuted the picture Walker had painted of woman suffrage bringing about Negro domination in the South by quoting the suffragists' favorite population statistics, showing that white women voters outnumbered eligible black citizens in the southern states. Then he tackled Walker head-on.
"There's been so much said about the Constitution of Tennessee and oath of office," he said in an even tone,
but then allowed his voice to rise.
"But certain interests have sent their lobbyists to ask members of this legislature to violate their pledges."
Suffs in the galleries rained down boos.
"And their agents are down at the Hermitage Hotel right now."
While Hanover was speaking, a knot of anti-legislators gathered behind the screen of the speaker's desk out of view. They whispered to one another, gesticulated, nodded in agreement, and returned to their desks. Charlie Brooks looked at his watch again. It was going on so long he really couldn't wait around for the vote. His train would be leaving soon, and he had to get home to his Ida.
"Tennessee never does things by halves for women," Hanover continued, but he could see his colleagues were getting restless, and he rushed to finish. "What we do for them as Southern men, we should have the privilege of doing for other women, that ours may be truly a democracy."
As soon as Hanover concluded, while the cheers for him were still reverberating, before he could even return to his chair, a rush of voices and raised hands clamored to be recognized. The voices and hands belonged to the same delegates who'd gathered behind the speaker's desk moments before. Finally, it was Seth Walker, still on the floor, who was recognized.
"I move this House adjourn until tomorrow morning,"
Walker announced, saying that the delegates needed more time to consider so momentous a decision. Chaos broke over the chamber.
"No! No!"
shouted Hanover and Riddick and other ratification leaders.
"No! No!"
was the echo from Suffs in the gallery. Further delay played into the anti's hands, the Suffs feared, gave them more time to pick off swaying delegates. More time for bribes, more time for intimidation, more time for simple confusion and doubt. The postponement over the weekend had been disastrous for the Suffs count. The test vote on clearing the floor had given the Suffs a hairbreadth majority of 51. They needed to vote. Today. But Walker's motion to adjourn took precedence. The roll call on the motion to adjourn began. The delay was too much for Charlie Brooks. He had to get home. He was sorry to bother Joe Hanover again about his personal problem, but Brooks's problem was the Suffs' problem, as they couldn't afford to lose a single vote now. "Just state a vote against adjournment," Hanover pleaded, then darted to the back of the chamber and found Luke Lee, explaining Brooks's situation. Lee went up to the gallery, where Newell Sanders was sitting, after being chased from the floor, and they rushed out of the State House together. Brooks did stay and voted against adjournment, but it was to no avail. With a solid anti-phalanx augmented by the merely hungry and testily tired, the motion to adjourn was approved by a vote of 52-44. The gavel rapped. The House was adjourned until 10:30 Wednesday morning. The Suffs in the gallery were silent and stunned. Josephine Pearson and her comrades were all smiles as they bustled down from the galleries. The hundreds of spectators still standing in the hallways looked confused. Luke Lee and Newell Sanders ran back to the State House with a plan. Sanders laid out $495 for a chartered train to take Brooks that afternoon directly to the nearest depot to his house, then wait. If Brooks's wife was well enough, the train would return him overnight to Nashville, and he'd be able to vote with the Suffs tomorrow. Lee and Sanders drove Brooks to Union Station. If any delegate who'd agreed to adjournment thought he was buying himself a respite, he was sadly mistaken. Even as they escaped down the Capitol steps, the delegates were overtaken and surrounded by red and yellow advocates. They were accosted on the sidewalks and barricaded on the curbs. They had uninvited companions at their luncheon table. They were pulled aside into Hermitage alcoves. The screws were tightened. At the Hermitage, Cat and Upton were livid, and they lashed out at the man they felt responsible for precipitating this turn of events, Warren Harding.
"Opposition only claiming unconstitutionality, and you fall into their trap,"
Upton berated Harding in a blistering telegram.
"This morning, Democratic Speaker of House read your letter and declared you upheld position of constitutional objectors. Not only Republican, but Democratic votes at stake."
Upton went on to the candidate's latest outrage.
"Your published interview on possibility of election contest will absolutely kill ratification unless counteracted. No such question exists. Imperative that you should send message that having been convinced constitutional objection is not well-founded, you still urge Republicans to vote for ratification. That message must come before 10 o'clock Wednesday morning. Notify me."
Carrie Catt didn't bother writing to Harding, addressing her complaint directly to RNC Chairman Will Hayes.
"Harding's letter to Tillman and morning paper interview has lost us votes, and unless counteracted, will bring defeat. The world will lay entire responsibility for defeat upon Harding. Immediate action is necessary. See Upton telegram to Harding. Carrie Catt Chapman."
Hayes, traveling between Marion and New York, didn't see Cat's wire until late Tuesday night. He telegraphed her near midnight, "Wire me any suggestions as to just what I should do." Upton received no reply from Harding. The move to adjourn was a stealth act perfectly executed. Seth Walker was a masterful parliamentarian, manipulating rules and procedures like a scalpel in the hands of a skilled surgeon. He'd outmaneuvered the suffs again. On the other hand, it might be taken as a sign that the antis were frightened of a vote, that they were delaying in an effort to postpone defeat. That was a comforting notion to the suffs, but they knew it was overly optimistic. The antis were most likely postponing in an effort to fortify their numbers. Walker claimed a majority already, and the adjournment vote showed 52 siding with the anti-led move, 44 resisting. Several men who were on the suffs' lists as favorable had voted to adjourn. Had they jumped the fence to the antis? Or was it hunger and fatigue, and perhaps fear propelling some of those aye votes for delay? The problem was, no one knew. Both sides scrambled through the afternoon to fortify and possibly augment their lines. Charles Williams, with the encouragement of Mrs. Cat, called all suffragists to the Hermitage Assembly Rooms for a pep talk and assignment sign-up. "Another poll must be taken by nightfall. Find your delegates. Take them to dinner if you can. Take them for a walk or drive if you're able. Take them to the moving pictures if you must. Just keep them in your sight." Volunteers were needed for policing duties. The Hermitage hallways must be patrolled throughout the night to make sure delegates could not attempt to slip or be spirited away. Suffrage soldiers must guard the platforms and passenger rooms of Union Station, so no cowardly or coerced delegate could leave town before the vote. Be prepared for a night without sleep. Joe Hanover hadn't slept for several nights, and he hadn't eaten much either. He never did get lunch after the adjournment, and he wasn't going to get any dinner tonight. He'd lost several pounds from his thin frame since the special session began. He reached into his jacket pocket for one of the graham crackers he kept there, his battlefield rations, and came up with crumb-coated fingers. With his clean hand, he went through his delegate poll again, checking off the men who were solid and those who were not. Then he made his rounds. By early evening, the Hermitage lobby was more crowded and noisy than ever, the whole scene blanketed by a layer of cigar smoke. Suddenly, a reporter for the Associated Press ran into the lobby, waving a long, narrow strip of paper torn from a newswire teletype machine. He stood in the center of the lobby and began reading the bulletin aloud in a booming voice.
"In a surprise maneuver, the North Carolina Senate has voted to postpone consideration of the ratification of the 19th Amendment until the 1921 legislature. The vote was 25-23 to postpone."
Anti-sympathizers in the lobby lustily cheered the news, and red-corsaged women laughed with glee as word spread throughout the hotel. Seth Walker was especially pleased. Those women wearing yellow were visibly shaken and tried to hold back tears, and some men looked grim and shook their heads. The vote in Raleigh was ominous to the suffs in more ways than one. Not only did it mean that ratification was dead in North Carolina, the Senate had been possible, in the House there was no chance, but it was the manner in which the Carolina antis had finessed the Senate vote that gave all suffragists in Nashville a fright. After hours of vicious debate, the senators had been ready to vote, and the suffs seemed to possess a slim margin to pass ratification. But before a motion to ratify could be proposed, the anti-floor leader jumped in to make a motion to postpone. Nervous senators welcomed this easier route, a way to opt out of a contentious issue. It was much safer to simply avoid voting. They could claim they'd not really voted against women's suffrage, just wanted to think about it a bit longer. This was a ploy that might be replicated in Nashville tomorrow. Lights burned late in the Hermitage as meetings and plotting continued, pleas were made and pressure applied. A knock on a delegate's door might bring a visitor bearing gifts, or the promise of sex, or even the threat of kidnapping. Harriet Upton was awakened several times in the wee hours to learn that a Republican member was missing. A hunting party went out to find him. Men of the Ratification Committee began knocking.